Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Doug Sovereign, reporter at KCBS Radio in San Francisco. I'm your moderator for this program. You can find me on Twitter at Sovereign Nation. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, or download our iPhone or Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's very special guest, Kathleen Turner, actress, activist, star of the play Red Hot Patriot, The Kick-Ass Wit of Molly Ivins, now playing at Berkeley Rep. For many of us, our introduction to Kathleen Turner came in 1981 with her sizzling performance in the hit movie Body Heat. That brought the first of her many Golden Globe nominations. She went on to star in some of the defining films of the 80s and 90s, including Romancing the Stone, Pritzi's Honor. She won the Golden Globe for both of those roles, by the way. Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Who can forget that? Peggy Sue Got Married, one of my personal favorites. Jewel of the Nile, War of the Roses, The Accidental Tourist, and so on and so on. She's also a big star on Broadway. She has starred in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, The Graduate, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, among many others. She's an Oscar nominee, a Tony nominee. She acts and directs on stages across America. She is even in Dumb and Dumber 2. Ms. Turner is also the author of a best-selling autobiography, Send Yourself Roses, Thoughts on My Life, Love, and Leading Roles. And she is a noted political activist, which may have something to do with why she wanted to play Molly Ivins on stage, and we're going to talk to her quite a bit about that. Please welcome Kathleen Turner.
Good evening.
So good to be with you here. Obviously a full house of enthusiastic fans.
It's a lovely house.
So let's begin with your current role. You're playing famous political journalist Molly Ivins. How did that come about? Was it that you wanted to be Molly Ivins, or that the twin sisters who wrote the play approached you? How did that happen?
Well, the sisters, Margaret and Allison Engel, twin sisters, who were journalists. One, Margaret, Peggy, is still active as a journalist. Allison is now teaching at USC. The day Molly Ivins died, they called each other and said, we have to do something about this. We have to write a play. And so they proceeded one of the biggest tasks is actually sorting through all the material that Molly wrote, you know, to make a structure of something that would play. And then they are both from Ohio, and this board member of People for the American Way. I've been on the board of People for the American Way for about 29 years. And I'm so glad we've got some supporters. So Jim Autry. Do I need this? Anyway, Jim Autry, who is a fellow board member, is a friend of theirs. And they told him about what they were doing. And he said, well, who do you want to play Molly? And they said, well, the best would be Kathleen Turner, but we don't know how to get the script to her. And he said, well, give it to me. And so he called me up and he said, I have a script for you. Well, I'm not going to tell a fellow board member that, to throw it away. So I said, well, of course I'll read it. And I loved it. I loved it. I never really planned to play Molly. I met her several times, and God knows I admire her, But the thought I consider what I do playing a character based on Molly Ivins, because, of course, there is only one Molly Ivins. Right?
So you didn't have too high hopes when you got this script. You thought, another person sending me a script. Well, and then you get it, and it turns out to be actually a pretty important and impressive work.
It really wasn't a play yet. This is the first time. This is the first time the Engel sisters had attempted a play, and there is a big leap between reading material and dramatizing it. So that it's the difference between you're going to a theater to see something or reading it. You have to. It has to be dramatized to the point where only seeing it live will bring it alive. So we had to find the way to do that, you know. And we did.
How familiar were you with her work before this was brought to you? And I know that you actually had met her a few times.
I was pretty familiar with Molly. We crossed paths because of our activism. She came to the People for the American Way event, you know, to speak. I went to the ACLU to speak. So, you know, our spheres of interest and anger crossed. But can I tell the story about meeting a girl? Okay.
No, you can't tell the story. Okay. No, go ahead.
Okay. Well, you guys know that Molly and Ann Richards were tremendous friends. You know, they were a very important relationship in both of their lives. So I live in New York, and I had an apartment on 66th and Broadway, the building there. And Ann Richards took an apartment there when she was undergoing the medical treatment for her final cancer there, at Columbia Presbyterian or something. So I come into the lobby one day, and Ann and Molly are standing waiting for the elevator. And, you know, Ann goes like this, and Molly goes like this. And they said, "Well, you're coming with us." I said, "Yes, I am." Yeah. So we went up to Ann's apartment, and I guess, you know, I was kind of fresh meat, you know, so they're having a good time with this new audience. Because this is what they did. They really told stories about each other all the time. So Molly kind of won because she told this story about Annie. She said that, you know, when Annie was just starting out in politics, all the real business was done at the backyard barbecues. No one did any work at the legislature, you know. Anyway, so Annie went to one of these events with a young woman who was her assistant and a young black man that she had hired recently for her office. So the good old boys would come up and they'd say, "You know, Annie, you are looking so lovely. And who's this sweet young thing you have with you?" And they just wouldn't see this young man at all. So Molly said Annie commenced to be perturbed by this. So when the next Bubba came up, she said, "Judge, I'm so glad to see you. I'd like you to meet my new husband." Swear to God. I mean, these women, this is all real. Yeah.
I can't imagine a better group of women to be sitting and telling, swapping stories with. You know, I'm a political reporter. I've met Molly Ivins a few times. Our paths crossed. And I have to say, having seen her show in Berkeley, you really do channel her in an extraordinary way. I mean, it's amazing. How difficult is it? I know you say that this is an adaptation, something based on a character based on a real person. But how difficult is it to portray an actual living or previously living
person? It is a fine line. And it did give me pause. The thought of, excuse me, actually, you know, trying to imitate Molly. First of all, that's kind of offensive to me, the thought of imitating someone else and the thought that she could be imitated. That's that's not my intention at all. So, you know, I'm an actor. I'm a good actor. So to act a character based on Molly, that I can do. To try and be Molly, that I cannot do. It doesn't make sense to my brain or whatever. But what I do know, there is, for example, this is a fun play. I mean, there are some big, wonderful laughs in it. And there is a commonality. There's a rhythm to good comedy, to good laughs. You know, Molly had it. Molly delivered her own lines probably better than anybody, you know. And I have the ability to do that also. So the similarities are kind of, and that and the passion and the anger, which I'm, you know, I think probably the women here very much understand that, you know, Molly said, you know, these my issues with lifelong rage. She said, well, thank God for that. Thank God for lifelong rage. Yeah. Thank God for lifelong rage. You know, it can accomplish a lot.
Can we talk a little bit about some of this political activism? I know people here are probably mostly want to hear, you know, stories about Michael Douglas and Jack Nicholson, and we'll get to that. We'll get to all of that.
Maybe.
But you are doing a show that is quite political in nature. You're portraying one of the great political journalists. What are the causes? You mentioned People for the American Way. What are the causes that you're most passionate about?
Most of my passion right now in my work is for Planned Parenthood. And, in September and October, I had September and October off. Yeah, right. So I went down to Texas 3 times for Wendy Davis and for Planned Parenthood, because to me, Texas is at the moment probably the most vivid example of backlash against women in this country. It is life-threatening. You know, the closure of women's health clinics, not necessarily abortion providers at all, simply women's health clinic. This doctor in Houston came to me and said that her clinic had been closed because of the TARP laws. Yeah? You know what that is. Okay. And she had diagnosed 5 cases of breast cancer the year before in her patients. Now that the clinic was closed, where these women would be diagnosed, when, and at what cost to their lives and their finances, we can't say. But almost certainly, it will be a great deal later and a much higher cost. This is not political. This is inhumane. I do not understand the attack that are coming back on women. I do not understand why. I mean, I'm old enough to have actually marched, you know? And we thought we'd done it, you know? We thought, well, thank goodness, now that's settled. We'll go on with our individual lives. But now, no. It seems as though we have to have this whole battle again. And I have a 27-year-old daughter, you know, who truly grew up, although she was dragged to many marches. Oh, yeah. Yeah, she wasn't pleased with me for a very long time. But in any case, she it never occurred to her that her rights as a human being would be infringed upon or limited. And yet, it is. They are becoming. Anyone who can take away your choices about your medical choices, your reproductive choices, controls your life. This is untenable. And if we have to fight it again, we fight it again. But I don't understand why. And I would if anybody's got a really good idea about why men are turning on us, I wouldn't mind hearing it.
Maybe during the question and answer.
No, maybe then. Other than sheer fear, you know. Just, yeah.
Do you feel? I mean, obviously, I would imagine you're grateful for the opportunity to be able to be active, and because of your fame, you can
imagine
that. Do you think artists have an obligation to be active?
I do.
In that way?
I think it's a responsibility. Look, I mean, I think you don't have to use your fame or something if you don't want to. You don't have to stand up and focus attention on something. It's not inherent in the job. But if you do use your ability to attract attention for something, then you must be very responsible about it, to my mind. You know, the fly-by-nighters who come in and highlight something that is socially exciting at this moment, do not earn my respect. But somebody who shows up year after year after year, yes, yes. And quite right, they should be respected. It is it's a big job, guys. I'm not complaining, you know, but it's on top of what else I do.
What do you say to people? Some are critical of artists, actors. Oh, what do they know about politics? Oh, these dilettantes and neophytes. How do you respond to the criticism of people who have that reaction?
Well, I'll tell you a story. This is what's good, because it makes me come up with stories. The National Press Club in Washington, D.C., they have a guest speaker once a month. Huh? Mm-hmm. Now, the rules are the guest gets to speak for 20 minutes, and then the whole press club corps gets to attack you for 40. You know? So a wise person does not go in without being pretty damn sure of what they're talking about. Well, the first time I spoke at the press club, it was for Child Help USA, which is an organization to help foster children, to train foster parents and everything, as opposed to, you know, a city or a state paying somebody $837 a month to take a kid. You know, this is it's a more supervised, and I think a much more, well, I know it's a much more successful program. Anyway, but the whole issue of the foster care system and everything in our country was kind of what the topic was. What, unbeknownst to me, Liz Taylor had been the guest the month before, and she was speaking on AIDS. And evidently, when it got to the question part, they said, you know, Miss Taylor, where did you get your information about this? And she went, Bob, you know, you want to answer this? And she wasn't responsible for the content of her speech. So they were waiting for me. They really, you know, I had 3 pages of references. And so the first question was, where did you get this information and how do you, you know, substantiate it? So I'm going, all right, that was this book published in 1977, and here is the reference point, which led me to this book, which is, all of which is quite true. I did my research, and I was right. In any case, so after giving 2 or 3 questioners all the possible background they could need, one of the press corps said, okay, I think she's got it, guys. You know? Now, you know, I think you can leave. So the second time I went this last 2 years ago to speak for Planned Parenthood and Women's Health. And they were much more respectful.
Okay, so let's go back to the beginning of your career. Let's go back in time a little bit. Body Heat, that was when I first became aware of you. Let's see, how old was I?
That was my first film, yeah.
Right, it was when Muscles were interested you, and, you know, I and many of my friends were quite impressed by your performance. It made you a huge star. I mean, did you see that coming, and what stories do you want to tell about that?
No, truly, I had tried to audition for the role in New York, and there were these two men who were casting directors, they were casting the film in New York, and they refused to let me audition. They refused to let me to get an audition with Larry Kasdan because I had no film experience, and to their mind, I was just wasting everyone's time. So about 3 months later, I went out to L.A. to audition for a different film, and a woman was casting the film in Los Angeles, and she heard I was there and called me in to read for Larry, because it's 3 months later and they still hadn't cast the role. So I read for her and Larry and the producer, and thought it went well, and went back to my hotel room, and they called in and said, would you come back tomorrow? And I said, sure, yeah, of course I will. And I went back, and Larry handed me a scene that he said, you know, no one's read this, no one, I just wrote it kind of thing. And I said, okay. So I read it, and he said, I never thought I would hear that out loud the way I hear it in my head. And I thought, okay. And so then they set up a screen test for Bill Hurt and me. And then we were told to wait 10 business days, which is endless, you know. It's 2 weeks. It's not 10 days. Yeah, it's 2 weeks. Yeah, that was the hardest part. But then they bring me back. I think it was Warner Brothers? Huh? It was 32 years ago, guys, all right? Any case, I go back to the studio because I have no film experience, and so the studio executives, you know, are quite anxious about this casting. I found out later that George Lucas stepped in and said, no, it's Kathleen Turner. But, so I'm in this white room, white chairs, white rug, white everything, and a coffee table with this huge ashtray overflowing with cigarette butts, huh? I mean, they'd been sitting in there a long time, you know? And so they brought me in, and they said something about, you know, well, be funny, or something like that. So I'm, you know, bumbling about, and I knock the ashtray off all over this white rug. And so I'm down on my hands and knees picking up these butts, and they laugh. And I'm funny.
And they said, she's our
stupid.
Star.
Yeah.
Well, that may have been the steamiest movie ever made.
Well, at the time, I think we broke real ground, yeah. You know. American attitudes towards sex are so hypocritical, you know. I mean, we use naked women to sell beer, you know, but we can't have sex education in the schools. Come on, guys, you know. Get real here. Oh. Okay, no, wait. No, that leads me to another story I have to tell. Because we did the play The Graduate. We built it. We did it in London, huh, on the West End. And there is full frontal nudity. Now, I was 46 then. And I was kind of proud of being 46 and doing it, right? So then they said, well, we'll take it to Broadway. And I said, no. No, I don't need the grief. You know, Americans are so screwed up about sex. I don't need this. So I took off to do another play, and I got a film script sent to me that said the character was 37, but still attractive. So I called up the British producer and said, we're going to Broadway.
Where you were a smash success in The Graduate.
At 48.
As Mrs. Robinson. 48, 48 yet still attractive.
But
isn't that
yet
shocking?
Still attractive. Yeah.
But back to Body Heat for a second. So was it, you know, we watched that movie and think steamy is the adjective of choice,
you know,
for that film.
It was
film.
Actually freezing.
That's what
you're
saying.
It was freezing cold. We were supposed to start the film in Florida in June, and then there was an actor's strike. So we couldn't start it until November, I think. So we started shooting this film in November, and it was cold. It was really, really cold. The crew is in snow jackets, you know, and then I had this terrible makeup man whose job it was to come up and spray me with sweat in this frigid air. I never saw him again. I never hoped to. In any case, yeah, it was seriously cold. We used to do things like, you know, if you keep ice in your mouth long enough, then when, you know, you spit it out when they say roll, and then your breath doesn't, you know, it doesn't cloud. It doesn't come out like, you know. And if you want, you hold your body rigid, 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 as long as you can, and they say roll, and then you can't shiver. See, all kinds of tricks, guys, you know. Anyway.
And yet when people see that movie, it's all hot and steam and heat and sultry south. And little do they know, you've got ice in your mouth and you're clenching your
teeth. Yeah, right. Well, the great scene, the breaking in the window, yeah? You know, which is still, I think, the sexiest moment in film or something like this was this endless night. We were trying out what a Steadicam, a camera that is now used all the time. But this was one of the first times he had been tried. And this, he wanted, Larry Kasdan wanted one shot where, you know, Maddie's standing in the entryway and Ned goes to one window and then he crosses to the door and then he crosses to the other. And so the camera was to follow him and look through each window with him as he, to build, you know, the tension. He tries this door, doesn't work. He tries this door, doesn't work. And that's when he finally picks up the thing. Well, the camera kept breaking down. And so this took all night. Finally, we're getting the shot, You know, Bill picks up the chair and smashes the window, and he grabs me, and we hear, cut. The sun is up. We couldn't keep shooting because it was too light. And so that's where we had to start the next night. Now, it's not the same. After an hour, after a whole night of trying to get this shot, it's not the same, you know? You really have to act there. Anyway.
I just want to remind our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program. Our guest is noted actress and political activist Kathleen Turner. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at the club's YouTube channel. Okay, so that's your first movie. You went through this whole ordeal. It's a success. You're a star. But did you think, what have I gotten myself into? This is what it takes to make a movie.
I don't think I had any idea of what the impact would be on my life. I'd done Broadway. You know, I'd done a soap opera for a while. I was making a good living as an actor, as a working actor. My highest ambitions at that point were to become a real stage star, you know, to become, oh God, Zoe Caldwell, you know, or that was my ideal. So Buddy Heat kind of happened to me, and I rather fell in love with filmmaking because it can be so incredibly precise. It can be just gorgeous. I mean, things that you can't do on stage. You can't, you know, they can't see my eyes after eight rows or something like this. But in War of the Roses, with a 150 millimeter lens that goes from here to here, when I blink, when I offer him the pâté, and he gives me the wine, when you blink is a whole sentence, you know? So this kind of precision and choices were just gorgeous, I thought, you know? So film kept me entertained for some time. I never went more than 2 years without being on stage because I never wanted to lose my love or my skill. And I met a lot of film actors who got frightened of stage because they stayed away too long and they were afraid of going back. In fact, when I went back to Broadway with Cat in the Hot Tin Roof, I can't tell you, I mean, Jack, Michael, Warren, they all call me up and say, don't do it, don't go. You know, they're going to kill you. You know, you're stage actors, you've got this target on your back. And I said, well, no, you don't understand. I'm better on stage.
That was going to be my next question. Were you better on stage? But was it a conscious effort to stay in theater even while you were having such a successful film career? Where, you know, the audiences are smaller, they're targeted, it's just New York.
Well, my first job after Body Heat was Titania and Hippolyta in A Midsummer Night's Dream and at Arena Stage in Washington. Oh, yeah, that was my... I go right back.
But which do you actually like better?
Or stage. Is that,
you prefer being on stage to being in film.
Yeah.
No, film maybe pays
I like
better.
Being with people. Oh, no, you have to do film because it does pay so much better.
Right.
And theater, you know, just doesn't. I mean, theater is really for the love of, you know.
Yeah, you keep getting extraordinary roles in theater. I mean...
Well, that was the other thing. Not that I was always aware that as I got older, there would be less and less work for me in film. Mm-hmm. Certainly in terms of Hollywood studio films, huh? And better and better roles in theater. Film doesn't have time to write deep characters. You know, you have to be identified right away. You're the sexual object, or you're the bitter, angry older woman, or you're the grandmother, or you're the, you know, the you have to be labeled right away for the camera to work. They don't write in-depth characters. I mean, really, truly, there was some of the if you see a really interesting character in film, it's probably the actor, guys. It is not the script. But in theater, it is the script and the possibilities. Doing Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was one of the highlights of my entire life. It was everything I hoped it could be. And you don't get to say that very often in life, yeah? And I can say it about that. And so I will always, always be grateful. Anyway, I won't get soppy.
What are some of the roles? Cat on a Haunted Roof, Mrs. Robinson in The Graduate, all these wonderful roles. What are some roles that you haven't done that you would really like to do? Are there some out there that you thought, if only someone will offer me X, Y, or Z?
Lear.
You want to be King Lear? Oh, you want to play all three daughters? Or?
No, Lear.
Yeah. Why not?
You got a problem with this?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Yeah, I'm working on that.
You have starred opposite some incredible leading men: Jack Nicholson, William Hurt, Michael Douglas, Danny DeVito.
Oh yeah.
Who are some of your favorites, least favorites? Any stories you want to tell?
Man, that's tacky. That's tacky. I don't really. I tell you, I've always had a great time with Michael and Danny. I mean, it's always been the three of us, you know, in all three films. And Michael and Danny were roommates back in college, you know, before they even finished college. I mean, in New York, they were roommates. And so they've been friends forever and ever and ever. And it was kind of cool. They sort of adopted me, you know, into the boys' club. So we had, you know, we do terrible things to each other and in the middle of Mexico, you know. It was fun. yeah. But... No, I'm never gonna say. Read the book.
Yeah,
there you go. Read my book. Yeah,
Princey's Honor. That was an amazing film.
Oh, that was great.
One for which you won great acclaim. Mm. Any stories you'd like to tell about
that? Well, John Huston is, you know, really. I mean, Princey's Honor was John at that point. This was his last really full film, and he was. He had very, very bad emphysema, and he could not move anywhere without an oxygen tank. And so it was an extraordinary opportunity in that John would say, you know, you to Jack and me, plan, you know, work something out, and then I'll come look at it, and then we'll bring in the cinematographer. So for the first time in a film, I got to do more of my blocking and everything and my own choices than probably ever before. But then I was off in Morocco shooting Jewel of the Nile, I guess, and John sent me a rough cut of Princey's Honor. It didn't have music, and it wasn't sound or color corrected or anything, but he wanted me to take a look at it. So I was watching this and getting really, really worried. It was so slow, and it was so ponderous, and it was so heavy-handed, and I thought, oh my God, you know, this could sink like a stone, man. And then, when I got back to the States, he'd put music to it. They had color corrected it, and suddenly this dark, you know, heavy-handed piece of filmmaking was transformed. That was the greatest lesson I learned about the entire machinery of filmmaking. Do you know what adding music could do? What color correcting the film could do? You know, it was just staggering from what I had seen as a rough cut. It was funny. I mean, wow. I didn't think there were any. When I thought there were laughs in it when I did it. You know, but not when I saw it the first time. You know, it was a great honor to work with John. He knew, I think one of the most skilled directors was Carl Reiner. When I did The Man with Two Brains with Steve Martin, Carl, we would say a line and Carl would go, okay, because he'd say, there are two beats, the audience is going to laugh there. Give it three beats or they'll miss the next line. Now, this is long before the film is cut, the film is seen, and Carl's going, yeah, hold the line because the laugh's going to cover it. Okay, Carl. Yeah.
Who knows
comedy? And he was right. He was right.
Who knows comedy better than Carl Reiner?
Amazing.
One of my favorite films of yours is Peggy Sue Got Married. Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah.
His nephew, Nicolas Cage. Mm-hmm. I think you shot it in the Bay Area, right? What didn't that take place
We shot up in Santa Rosa. Out here, yeah.
Yeah, so that was a local film with a local filmmaker, an icon in the Bay Area. How was it working with Francis Ford Coppola and the fact that his nephew was, you know, was a big star turn for him in the film with you?
Well, it was Nick's first big role, huh? And he was a bit of an asshole. I think a lot of it was Nick was very concerned about being thought it was nepotism, that he wasn't cast for his talent or his ability, but he was cast because he was a nephew. So he kind of went out of his way, you know, he kind of dissed Francis a lot, which was unnecessary. Sort of trying to prove that he was separate and, you know, he got this on his own. I don't know. I mean, Francis is a lovely, lovely man. There's no reason to give him any disrespect. It was very, very intense, that shooting. I can't remember. Once Francis came to me, and he had this silver bullet, this kind of trailer, and he has screens up. Now, keep in mind, we're shooting one camera. So he may have multiple screens, but there's only one thing showing, you know? And he says, would you mind if I direct from my trailer? And he's done this before. He'd have a walkie-talkie, and the first AD would hold the walkie-talkie out while Francis gave direction. While he's sitting there, no. I said, no, I don't mind at all. I will act in mine. So then he said, oh, so you want me on set every time you're there? I said, yes, I do. And he said, well, then you have to be on set every time I'm there. And I said, all right, fine, fair trade. Not really thinking that there were like two scenes I wasn't in and I could have slept. You know, I could have gotten some sleep, man. My now ex-husband, who is a lovely man, came out to Santa Rosa, you know, came out, and he said in the middle of the night, we were sleeping, and he turned over, and I went, no, it won't match. And I turned him back. And he was afraid to move for the rest of the night.
And in that film, I mean, the challenge of the time travel and you're playing, it's an older woman who's then back in high school or...
I didn't use any makeup or anything, no. No, it's
you wore
really...
You a little skirt, so you were, you know...
Yeah, but no, really, bobbing. I mean, that's really ages. Young Peggy Sue had to not know what older Peggy Sue knew, right. You know? So that... You'd be amazed, you know, how all our experiences... Layer on each other to the point where if something happens to you, if you hear a word or phrase or see something, it triggers a cascade. You have an immediate reaction. But if you, it's like watching a child. You can, a little baby has to learn that they're separate physically. You know, I can remember when my daughter, you know, was playing happily one day and kind of went and just figured out this was attached. You know? And so, like when you watch a child, you see that they have no preconceptions and all of our automatic reactions could be peeled back. you know, to where you don't know much. You don't have the same reaction because you don't have the same knowledge. And that was the secret of playing younger.
So is that common for you as an actor to draw upon those kinds of memories and internal, the types of things you're talking about in different roles to access what you need to access to play that part?
Well, I am not a method actor. I think that's, I don't understand it, and I think it's incredibly self-aggrandizing. Mm-hmm. Hmm? You know, how I feel, what I want. No, it's what the character wants. It's what the director wants. You know, you're, once you agree to sign a contract and play something, it is no longer your judgment. You are subjected to the director's judgment, the writer's judgment. Your job is to portray to you the best of your ability what they want, not what I want. I mean, obviously, ideally, it becomes a meld, a marriage, and it usually does. But, what triggered that? Oh, okay. No, there are inescapable memories and emotions that you do draw on because you almost can't not. There's a moment thinking of Peggy Sue when she picks up the phone and hears her grandmother's voice, who in her world has been dead for many years. I heard my father's voice. My father died when I was 17 and never had the chance. I have two brothers and a sister. My father never got to know any of us as adults, which is so wrong, such a shame. So to me, the value of Peggy Sue hearing her grandmother's voice was the value of if I could hear my father's voice again. So that rang true. So in that way, you bring your own life and memories in. But it's not about you, you know.
That had to be very powerful, though, for you.
Yeah.
I just want to remind our audience that we are going to let you ask some questions of Ms. Turner. So if you have something to ask,
yes,
think about that.
Yes, or any answers also.
The microphone is not in place just yet. We're a few minutes away. We're a few minutes away from that. But we're going to get the microphone up, and I don't know if we want people to start lining up, but think about it. And I'll give you another warning in a couple of minutes. Who framed Roger Rabbit? That was a fun one.
That was extraordinary. I mean, that is something that will never be made again because you realize what Zemeckis did and the whole crew. They hand-painted on each frame, you know, the animation. Now, of course, it's all computer-generated, or it can be. But this was the first real marriage of life and animation. And it was... It's an incredible process, what they did. And Bob would send me, you know, all the sort of tapes along the way of the process. For example, they would use this, a stand, you know, a stand to signify Jessica so that the actors would have something to refer to and aim at when they started to draw in the character, and then they say, well, do you think she would breathe here, or how would she, you know, because we want to, I mean, with those boobs, guys, we had to put it in some, you know, so they'd bounce. Anyway, we're going through the whole thing now. Also at the time, I was 8 months pregnant, which was perfect. You know, it was perfect. I'm waddling into the studio, and all you have to know is my voice. But about what, you know, where would she breathe? How would she phrase this? That kind of stuff. So that the acting could all kind of come together, even though I was not on set. But the whole process was fascinating, you know, and it will never be done again.
During the actual animation and filming of the live characters, you would have to come in so that they could pace everything and work it out, and then
somewhat,
later,
yeah, and then ultimately, but the face is the last thing, of course. The mouth and the eyes and everything is the last thing. So that has to be set to, that can only be drawn once I've done the final recordings.
Once you've recorded the voice.
And what is the great line? I'm not bad.
I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way.
It was classic. Now I will ask, if there's something you'd like to ask Ms. Turner, you can start lining up at the microphone and we'll take your questions. And a reminder, we'd like them to be questions as brief as you can so we can get to the answers, which we're far more interested in. Maybe not. So, sir, you're first in line and eager to go. What's your question for Ms. Turner?
Okay, I really enjoyed your role as China Blue
in
the cult classic Crimes of Passion. Mm-hmm. Do you have any reflections on that movie?
Yeah, that was Ken Russell, who the director, and who is a mad genius, who was a mad genius. He truly was a genius, I believe, but also quite self-destructive in many ways. So he was very difficult to work with. When I talked to Bill Hurt before I started to work on Crimes of Passion, because Bill had done Altered States with Ken just before. And Bill told me that, Ken had a case of scotch in his trailer, and a bottle was opened at 6 a.m. and, through the day. But when I was working with Ken, it was wine. So I was in a better place than the scotch. But being offered wine at 5 o'clock in the morning is not cool. I'll tell you, when in my book I wrote about Ken's drinking and some of the problems with Anthony Perkins, who was doing Lord knows what cocktail, honey, but he did it openly, which is the only reason I would say something about it, because it wasn't hidden at all. But so Ken wrote me a letter last year saying that he thought I was kind to him in my assessment. But meanwhile, he was going to do a new film of Alice in Wonderland, and would I consider playing the Red Queen? And by the way, I would be clothed, but the rest of the court would not. I was trying to figure how to answer this when Ken died rather suddenly, so I didn't have to. But I had no idea what I was going to say.
Next question, sir.
I'm Michael Burkett, freelance journalist. And you made reference to the fact that you work with nonprofits and things like that. George Carlin also said the same thing. He never did go on camera for any of those. He stated that he always worked in the background. Where do you work?
I show up at all the events. Anything that has my name on it, I am there. My name is not allowed to be used unless I am physically there. I travel the country to Planned Parenthood affiliates in between jobs to create fundraising and, liaison with the community. I show up at marches. I show up at freezing events against gun control in Washington, D.C. last year when I had pneumonia. I didn't know I had pneumonia until I got home, though. I didn't realize I had pneumonia then during the march. That was after. I'll tell you, I do try City Meals and on Wheels. I deliver meals. I do try not to. I take on only 4 or 5 organizations because I can't do more. I can't do more and hold to my standards, which is to be there. Yeah?
Is it hard? Is it hard to say no to people when they come to you and want to ask
yes,
you, knowing that you're an activist?
No.
And
it is hard to say no. But I simply say, look, I can't follow through. Maybe I could do this one thing for you, but I can't follow through, and that's not how I operate. That's not what keeps my name valuable. Huh?
First of all, I would like to say that you were beautiful and wonderful in Romancing the Stone. As an acting student in the Academy of Arts, I wanted to ask you, what you find the most rewarding as a practitioner of the craft of acting?
What do I find most rewarding?
Yes.
Okay. I find stage most rewarding because, I'll tell you exactly why. In a theater, unlike almost any other place left to us, you sit closer to a stranger than you do in your own home. There's a little divider between you and this complete stranger whose faith you don't know, whose belief, you know, whose attitudes or political beliefs you don't know. You sit there in trust because you make an agreement when you come into a theater and sit down. You're already extending a kind of trust. Then if the play is good, if the people, you know, you start to breathe together. You hold your breath together. You laugh at the same time. And you become part of something more than an individual. And I think all human beings need that. That's why theater has been so effective for so many centuries, guys. You know?
Right? Thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah, the need for that communal experience. There's a famous quote about that.
I think so.
Who said, someone more esteemed than I had a beautiful line about that very topic, and I'll try to remember it by the time we're done. Sir, your question for Ms. Turner?
Hi, yes, my name is Oscar Velarde. I'm a current acting student at the Academy of Art University, and I'm very interested to hear what is the most valuable piece of acting advice that you've received throughout your career, or probably even as a student in...
Well, I teach also, and I enjoy it tremendously. I think I'm a good teacher, and I know as I get older I'll do more and more teaching, unless 8 shows a week, guys, you know. My course, when I'm in New York for a semester, which usually means I'm on Broadway, I teach at NYU on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I have two two-hour sessions for juniors and seniors. I can take 12 people at a time. And the course is called Practical Acting, Shut Up and Do It. And that is my advice.
Thank you very much.
Sir.
You did a great movie with Dennis Quaid, and I know...
Undercover Blues.
Yeah, oh, it was a wonderful movie, so politically incorrect. You were shooting guns off while carrying a baby around.
Oh, yeah, it was great fun.
Were you worried about the political correctness, or how is... When you do comedy...
Oh, no, we made sure the baby was safe. You know. I was just tickled pink by the idea of being able to do both at the same time. You know, watching the kid take the first steps and then, you know, teaching it how to hide, you know.
It was, I love your comedy, I love the jewels, and you just have such great timing.
I do, thank you.
Two quick questions. Virginia Woolf, New York. At the end of the play, you were wiping away tears, and I was wondering, was it the role? Was it something you were thinking of? Was it your dinner plan? What was the... or was it the physicality?
No, actually, she didn't always cry at the end at all, because in fact, what Bill Irwin and I found with the help of Anthony Page, our director, was, you know, the... firmly believe that Martha and George truly loved and could not live without the other. Whatever the abuse, whatever the surface showed, these were two people who truly loved each other deeply. So I don't really believe that I cried. What I believe was that I was going through severe menopause. And I was sweating like hell.
I thought I recognized that. Last question's oddball, and that is, kid of mine, female at USC in film, wants to be a cinematographer. Have you ever run into a female cinematographer in Hollywood?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yes, I've employed them. Why not?
Well, I just want to make sure I'm not wasting a tremendous amount of money.
No. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You're a good father.
Many gifted female cinematographers and directors, no question.
Hello, my name is Mickey.
Before you ask your question, sorry, I just want to ask one follow-up thing. You talked about being in Virginia Woolf with Bill Irwin, who is a noted mime and clown and comic and incredibly funny man.
Yeah.
And you have gone back and forth a bit between comedy and drama. What is that like, to do both and to do both well, and is one harder than the other?
Well, in some ways it is, because drama essentially is keyed into, you know, your big gut emotions of fear or pain or joy, or, you know, they're gut-to-gut communication, huh? Comedy is thoughts. You know, when you make someone laugh, you've made them think. So in some ways, that's harder than just making someone feel your loss or your fear, you know. Comedy is trickier.
Yeah, why do you think that maybe comedy doesn't get as much respect, that it's not taken as seriously as real acting and dramatic scripts?
Because they're pretentious. Yeah, fine.
Okay,
right, your turn.
Are you sure? You ready?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay, just want to make sure.
Please.
My name is Mickey. I'm a mental health and substance abuse counselor, and I want to say thank you for all you do in giving back to the community and everything, and your Planned Parenthood is huge. My question for you is, how were you approached on Serial Mom, and what was it like to work with John Waters?
Oh, boy. I love John. I love it. We still have a great friendship. He was just honored by the Lincoln Center Film Society for 50 years of filmmaking. John shows up in this pink and red outfit.
I love him.
You know? I mean, I don't know what he looked like, a Valentine or something, you know. Anyway, and he's so thrilled. You know, he can't believe Lincoln Center is honoring John Waters, you know, for God's sake. And he wanted me to introduce Serial Mom because he was showing all his films.
Right.
John has a unique quality in that. He's the least malicious. He creates these grotesque characters that you love.
You love.
You know, that's a gift. And you will never see John in person or in his work hurting someone. You know, taking maliciousness to a point where someone is really hurt. Never gonna happen. You love his freaks. I mean, Beverly is a freak. You know, she just looked normal.
Right.
You know, right. But it's extraordinary. He has a great talent.
He's a great guy. Thank you very much.
Yeah. You're up.
My name's Anne. The first reason I had to get up here and ask you a question is because all of them are men.
I'm glad to see you.
You know, you're such a complex person, because you do drama, you do romance, you do adventure, and you've got all your political passions. Is there one role in particular, or two in particular, that feel to you like a synthesis of all that you are?
I tell you, this Molly Ivins comes close, this Red Hot Patriot, because I mean, someone said to me, well, you know, if you're such a great actress, could you do Sarah Palin? I said, no. No, I really couldn't. You know, I think that would be just pretending to me, which is not the same as acting, you know. This woman, Molly's words that are so well chosen. She was an extraordinary writer, you know, and tremendously knowledgeable about the political, how the politics worked and all. They just taste good, you know? It's really fun.
Okay.
Thank you for that thoughtful question. You get a second bite at the apple, sir.
I thought he looked familiar.
Oh, okay. My question is, as a person that has had experience in both
you
the medium...
You have to back off from the mic a little. The mic. There you go.
There you go.
Okay. Is this good? Here. As a... Right here. As a person that has had experience in both the medium of film and stage, which one of the two mediums are the most physically and mentally and emotionally demanding?
Stage is 1,000 times more demanding. I'll tell you why. People, like, for example, I'm here in Berkeley, right, doing a play, and my friends back east or something say, well, did you get to do this? Did you go there? Did you go to San Francisco and have this great meal? Did you do it? No, here's my day. I try and work out every morning. I have Pilates or yoga or some kind. I have rheumatoid arthritis, and I need to keep physically as active as I can. This is part of it. I have to watch how much I speak all day in order not to overuse the voice. I have to be aware of how much I talk on the phone, which is a different use of your voice from your thing. I have to know when and where I eat. I don't eat after 2:30 because I like to be empty before when I go on stage at 7 or 8. I lie down between 3:30 and 4:30 because I need that kind of focus and to rest the body. This is Olympic athlete training stuff, guys. What you eat, when you eat, how much activity you have, how much vocal activity you have, what your thoughts are, and how much you allow yourself to be distracted from your job that evening is a discipline. And it takes all your time. If I'm doing a play in London, I'm not going out. You know, I don't go out here. This is my night off. You know? I mean, this is the exception. And I could be sleeping.
We appreciate your spending your night off with us. I just want to say.
I'm enjoying it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah. All right, we have time for one last question from the audience, and I think it's fitting that we end with a woman. Thank God.
So I just listened to Amy Poehler's Yes, Please, the audiobook, and you were in that. And so I was just, how did that happen? And
Called me up. Amy Poehler's book was just did an audio version of it. Huh? So she calls me up, and actually she emailed me first and said that she was recording her book, and there's one chapter particularly about, you know, that terrible little voice in a woman's head, right, which she calls the demon, the voice that says, you're wearing that? You know? You think that looks good? Yeah. So she wrote me this email. She said she always envisioned this voice sounding like a cross between Kathleen Turner and Darth Vader. And she hoped I wasn't offended. But when I consider it, I wrote her back and I said, demons are my specialty. Yeah. So then we called each other, and she is delightful. Yeah. I like her so much.
That was a great audio book. How she had all the people and.
Well, see, that's all fake. Yeah, we pretended like, you know, all these people are in the booth at the same time, right? And we've all come together to record the book for Amy. Of course, we're not all together at all, but we're like going, okay, you know, you get to no, I want to no, you know, why don't we let Amy read it? Yeah. But so all this. So it sounds like we're a crowd, but we're not.
Okay, thank you.
Now we know your next role will be in one of the Star Wars films.
Yeah.
We've got to get George Lucas on the horn. Well, unfortunately, we have run out of time. Our thanks to Kathleen Turner, actress, activist, starring now in... She... She is starring now in Red Hot Patriot, The Kick-Ass Wit of Molly Ivins. If you have not seen this play yet at Berkeley Rep, it's been extended because it's such a success. You have a few more weeks. We're more than a month still. Yeah. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Doug Sovereign, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.